Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Well, as previously mentioned, we have a great panel discussion from the recent ASC meeting titled Failing Forward. In this discussion, hosted by Dr. Justin Dimmick and Dori Segov, we have speakers Timothy Pollock, Michael Englesby, Melina Kibbe, Mary Hahn, Keith Lillimo, and Carla Pugh all talk about a poor career decision and how they recovered. We were fortunate enough to hear this panel live at the recent ASC meeting, and we all found it very inspiring and motivating as younger surgeons. So we spoke with Dr. Dimmick and all the speakers on the panel and got their approval so we could release it on our podcast so others may enjoy it as much as we did. So thank you once again to Dr. Dimmick and all the panel speakers. And here's Dr. Dimmick with the introduction. Enjoy.
The focus of this session is something, is failure, something that I think is an important theme, because as you all come to these meetings, especially the younger folks, you sometimes see talks like the one I gave and the introduction by Caprice, and it looks like we got to where we were without having any, without stumbling and falling, and particularly without failure, and that's not true. There are a lot of failures along the way. In fact, everything we do is the secret of success is probably persistence and resilience and not brilliance, to be perfectly honest. And thus, we decided to focus on this theme for this session. The quote that I put in the learning objectives for this is by Winston Churchill, and that is that success is defined as going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. And that is a theme that I think our speakers will pick up on today. We have an unbelievable group of speakers today. They are all leaders in American surgery. They're also wonderful speakers and thoughtful leaders. So, one other thing I want to do is introduce my co-moderator here, Dori Segov. Dori and I were medical students together at Johns Hopkins a long time ago. And I asked Dori to co-moderate with me and do some DJing of the session. Specifically, he has chosen walk-up music that suits the personality of each speaker. So you can all draw what conclusions you want from that. I take no responsibility for any of the choices or anything else Dori does today or tonight. And I wanted to mention that because this previews Dori tonight is DJing our main event celebration tonight. Dori is a very famous and well-funded transplant surgeon. He did the first live donor nephrectomy in Nepal, but he also is a very accomplished DJ. So I think you'll come tonight, you'll appreciate his skill at that. So without further ado, I'll introduce our first speaker, Dr. Timothy. Can't wait till the music starts. Dr. Timothy Pollock from Johns Hopkins.
He's just afraid of what I've chosen.
Desirable difficulties, how underdogs and those who fail come to excel. So we're asked to talk about a particularly poor decision and how we recovered. So I thought I'd start off about a very personal experience for me, and some of you may have heard this story about a bad decision. So I met my wife on a blind date, and I identified myself as the individual who would be wearing the striped shirt in front of a certain restaurant. And come to find out, I did not attend the Dress for Success lunch that preceded this event. And according to my wife, I was wearing some particularly bad footwear at the time. Now, when I met my wife, I immediately knew, she wasn't my wife at the time, but I immediately knew that I wanted to marry her. She had zero interest in me, so I needed a plan. And the plan I had came from George Costanza and Jerry Seinfeld. I don't know if you are familiar with this episode, but George is seeking advice from Jerry about how to be with a certain woman. And Jerry said, be there for her. And then after a while, you'll just be there. So I think this personal failure in the way I was dressed and perhaps even the way I approached my wife initially exemplifies one way of how I overcame something. Persistence, perseverance, and also a plan. When I think about my professional failures, I think it was so challenging to do this because I have a sea of failures. I think there's another famous quote from Churchill who said, if I didn't have failures, I'd have nothing else to talk about. When I look around, I think my life is littered with a number of different failures. When I look back, there is a number, I would say, of failures both in medical school and residency and more recently in my faculty life that really defined me. And I think even small failures can have an enormous impact. One failure that I had in medical school is I can remember writing a paper in medical school and working so hard on it for weeks and weeks and months and months. And that paper never got published. And that may explain today why I am neurotic about making sure that everything that my students and my residents and my fellows work on ends up getting published. And I can tell you to this day, I still remember that example of having failed to publish that paper as a medical student, and it drives me. Another failure was the match. I did a sub-I at Hopkins, and actually, I don't know if Keith remembers me as a fourth-year medical student, and I desperately wanted to go to Hopkins. I ranked them first. And no offense to Justin, I think John Burkmeyer and some of the other Michigan guys or former Michigan guys, I matched at Michigan, which was my fifth choice. But I remember being, I know, it's true. But I remember being devastated to the point of tears when I opened up that match letter, thinking that I would never gonna be able to overcome that. And then, funny how it works, is now I'm at Johns Hopkins on faculty. The other failure that I feel present in my current life right now is my lack of R01 funding. And that's something I still have a little bit of a complex about. That was surrounded by people like Dory and Justin, you know, who have probably like 10 R01s amongst them in Caprice. I chose a different route. You know, I've applied for grant funding, I'm co-I on some grants, but I am not an independent investigator in R01 funding. That is a failure, at least in my eyes. But how have I overcome that? So I think of different examples. The example from medical school, a small failure that has motivated you for a long time. I think of Michael Jordan. What did Michael Jordan bring up when he's being inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame? Is probably the most successful basketball player of all time. He talked about how he was cut from his varsity team in high school and how he still remembered that and that was driving him all those years. So I think we can use our failures to motivate us and to drive us. The other thing is that with the match, you know, I was very disappointed, but I made a commitment that I was gonna work as hard as humanly possible. And I do think that most things in life are 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. I remember interviewing at MD Anderson for my fellowship with Lee Ellis, one of the physicians there, and I told him, he's like, what makes you unique? And I said, I'm a pretty hard worker. And he says, well, you mean to tell me you work harder than anyone else? And I said, well, I'm gonna try. And then the other thing about not having R01 funding, and how do you overcome that? I think it's defining what success means for you, and that we all have different paths, we all have different journeys, and for each one of us, success will look differently. I was a little bit nervous about this session because I think that when you see all the people that are going to be talking today, we're all somewhat successful. And I think there's a danger in talking about our failures. It can be a straw man. So just like a straw man argument is when you create a false argument that is easy to rip down to show how you've won, we can create straw men failures and then show you how we've overcome them. And I somewhat fear that for some of the young people in the audience, that you're gonna feel like double failures, that you have a failure and that you see one of us overcoming it, but you feel not empowered in your current situation to overcome that failure, and it's just gonna be even worse for you. So the other real failure that strikes home to me is surgical failure. I think that we, the Association for Academic Surgery, and many people probably will be talking about academic failures. But the thing that really hits home to me is surgical failure. And I'm a big baseball fan. I know Keith's a big baseball fan. So what do they call someone who bats 300 in baseball? 3 out of 10 successes. An all-star. What do they call someone who bats 400? 4 out of 10 successes. Like Ted Williams, a legend. What do they call a surgeon who has 5 out of 10 successes? A loser. So I think when we think about failure, one thing that I am concerned about for young faculty and young residents is how do we deal with surgical failure? When we have bad outcomes in the operating room, we help a lot of people, but we also hurt some people. And I think that many of us are confronted with this type of failure. And we heard yesterday, Sharon touched on this a little bit in her talk, how it can be really, really trying. You can feel shame, guilt, isolation, and insecurity. And I think the way to overcome this, and I've done this myself in my own personal life, is you need to get help, you need to talk about it, you need to accept it, and you need to improve. Because it can be very daunting to try to accomplish all these things, surgical excellence, educational excellence, research excellence, and it really can be like Malcolm Gladwell stated, it's like David and Goliath. And how do we overcome these overwhelming odds? And we can't be passive. And this is a book that I recently just finished reading. I think it's very insightful, and it kind of frames this session, if you will, and how we think about failure and how we can overcome it. You know, courage is not something that we already have, but courage is something that you earn because you've been through tough times and you discover that they're not tough after all. And I would ask that when you hear people talk about their failures today, think about two concepts. One is the concept of the inverted U curve. And this is the idea that we are better through our failures. If we do not have failures, we will not be challenged. We will have paralysis. If we have too many failures, we will be destroyed. So we want to understand a place where we have some failure, we can be comfortable with some failure that will push us to be better. The other concept is the magnitude of the failure. And there's this interesting concept about when Germany bombed London and how they thought they'd break the Brits' will. But you can see here, this person's delivering milk and he feels pretty good about it, and he admits of tons of failure. So when we think of failures, there's certain failures that would be direct hits that are just devastating and end up destroying our career. And I know of individuals who have had very bad operative outcomes and who have never gone on to operate again. That's a direct hit. Or someone who has applied for a grant and never resubmitted it and gets discouraged and never tried again. That's a direct hit. Then there's near misses, where we're close, we have a big failure and we feel it, but it doesn't destroy us. But this can lead to paralysis and preoccupation. But then there's these remote misses, where we have a failure, but we're able to overcome it. And I think that's what we're going to be hearing about today. And this leads to excitement and this triumphant feeling that we feel more empowered because we were able to overcome that failure. And hopefully that's what this session is going to do for you. So when we think about success through failure, I think the number and the magnitude of the failures are important. There can't be too many rungs on the ladder that are broken. Maybe having one or two broken will make us try harder to climb higher. But there also can't be too many of them, and the breaks in the ladder can't be too big. So one of my last slides is my hero, Abraham Lincoln. And here are Lincoln's famous failures. I mean, there's no one who's failed more than Abraham Lincoln, but no one whose star probably shines brighter in the history of leadership success than Abraham Lincoln. And it even took 2 or 3 times on the convention floor for Lincoln to get the nomination to even run for president. But Lincoln had a plan, Lincoln had perseverance, Lincoln had a team, and Lincoln had a passion. He had a passion. He felt very passionate about his causes, and that drove him. So with that, I'll conclude, and I look forward to a conversation if time permits.
Thank you, Tim. So our next speaker will be Mike Inglesby from the University of Michigan.
My kids would know that song. I'm embarrassed to say I'm a big enough nerd. I don't even never even heard that song before. So, middle-aged fashion tips from a Midwestern surgeon, right? It's not where you go for hipness. So I want to. Justin asked me to essentially tell a story that many of you have heard before, and I want to thank Tim. Tim's a big part of this story because Tim introduced me to my wife, and Tim demonstrated what kind of high level. What a high-level talk is about, and I'm going to go low bar. So we all have our doppelgangers. I just wanted to do that because I love Tom Brady so much, and it really has nothing to do with my talk. You know, he went to Michigan, and he didn't rank it fifth on his scholarship list. Anyway, no. So on cue this morning, I'm running with two of the residents and one of the medical students. I'll protect your names. And I was asked, as you know, many of us kind of middle managers or higher level people are asking, you know, what job do you want? What do you want to do next? And I get to ask this question all of the time. I'm real involved in medical student education, my institution. And I'm like, I have the best job in the world. The only person who I think has a better job than me is Tom Brady. And I say this all the time. Any student in the room, I say this like three times a week. And then when I thought about it for this talk, I'm like, actually, our job is better than Tom Brady's because, you know, we have this amazing ability to help patients. We have this ability to impact the health and wellness of society. We get inspired. We get to discover. Being an academic surgeon is the best job in the world. And I wouldn't trade kind of what I get to do with anyone. But, you know, in the process, it kind of sucks in times getting there, and I'll talk about a time that really has been a challenge for me. I grew up in the rough streets of Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I went to, you know, lots of private schools and exclusive type places. Medical student admissions, which I'm very involved in now at my institution, works really well because I barely got into medical school. But nonetheless, I somehow matched at Michigan for residency. And actually Tim introduced me to my wife, so I'm engaged. My wife matches in cardiology in Seattle. So I go to Seattle to do my lab time with Dr. Mahan, who's my ran the program at the time, set me up with this wonderful surgeon named Alec Clues, who just passed away this year. Great man, big time scientist, vascular surgeon, absolute gentleman. I had a great experience, but I'll tell you about some of the challenges. I don't do basic science anymore, and you'll see why. So my job was to do this baboon trial on vascular biology, neonatal hyperplasia, platelet-derived growth factor. Dr. Clues had a huge lab, there was 20 or 30 people, and I show up. And I'm very excited. I've never done anything academic in my life. I've never written a paper. My first meeting I ever went to was actually during the lab time was this some kind of career development thing by the AAS. And everyone is so excited to see me. It's like 20 or 30 people. It's like high fives, Inglesby's here, awesome. I'm like, what? Everyone's so nice in Seattle. I'm like, awesome. And I figured out why about 3 months later. So I start off in this trial. I do 10 baboons, aortoiliac bypasses. Like, that's like a surgical resident's dream. I always want to do transplant. This is kind of like transplant. It's like vascular surgery. Great, 10 baboons, awesome. No one taught me how to do it, but you know, you can figure stuff out when you have to. So then I went on to the next, let's count them out, 90 baboons. So I did a trial with 90 baboons. And I did these bypasses, and I started giving them study drug. And the study drug was given an unfortunate frequency, every 4 hours. So let's go through that, study drug. Baboon, ketamine, sedation, IV, infusion of study drug, wake up baboon. Doing, you know, and go about your day. That happens at 6 a.m., 10 a.m. Keep going, I'll lose the math. But there's one at 10 p.m., by the way, and 2 a.m. in there. I did this for over a year. So That was harder than like being an every other night intern. It was way harder. You start to lose your mind. And in a lab of 30 people, somehow no one else was able to get credentialed to go into the primate center. This is mud. If I'm nothing, I'm tough, I think. So at least I used to be, not anymore. I'm not gonna complain, I'm gonna do this. I said I was gonna do it, no problem. But it gets worse. Because when you pull the baboon into the cage and you sedate it, there's baboons everywhere. There's 20 of them in this primate center. Baboons, turns out, didn't like me very much. And they had three things they would do to me. One is they take a crap in their hand and they throw it at me. Two is, turns out a juvenile baboon can urinate with great accuracy for about 25 feet. And the third thing, I see Mary is here, so I'll say, the third thing, this one baboon liked me a lot. I'll just leave it at that. So it took about 15 months to go through all this, and I had poop in my hair for a long time. But you have to innovate. So they didn't do this to anyone else. It was just me. They didn't do that to the handlers and stuff. So, you know, okay, we'll persevere. So I decide to try a couple innovative solutions. The single worst idea in the history of academic medicine. That's all I'll say. But I tried like 20 or 30 different kind of things, and one of them worked. And I think it's one of the key kind of, it's probably the highest level lesson from this little rant, is that when times get tough, consider cross-dressing. So I dressed up as Marilyn Monroe. I had a Marilyn Monroe wig, black glasses, and a black smock. And that pretty much stopped the poop throwing and the urination. That baboon still liked me. So I guess the moral of my story is a couple things. One is I don't do basic science. I actually was not good at it. It was great to have that experience to kind of figure out kind of how hard it is. And I respect it so much and how I'm not doing it. And then I think the other one is kind of this. Along the way, you'll get crap thrown at you. Being a surgeon is really hard. I tell medical students, like, you could drink from the water fountain, you could drink from the fire hose. We drink from the fire hose. But it's so worth it. And then one day, students and residents, if you're willing to kind of go through the mud, you'll have a job that's even better than Tom Brady's.
If his job's better than Tom Brady's, I think I need to talk to Dr. Mahalan about a raise. Thank you, Mike. So our next speaker is Melina Kibbe from Northwestern University.
Microphone. That was perfect. I'm a total nerd, total sci-fi nerd. Yes, went and saw Star Wars right when it came out, dragged my poor husband, so thank you. So I cannot believe I have to follow that, because I am not funny or entertaining, and oh my God. But it also, as I'm hearing the stories from Tim's to yours, it's like the whole 6 degrees of separation, because you're going to, I actually have a connection with your story as well as Tim's. It's unbelievable. So who am I? So first off, I'm a surgeon. I think everyone in this room identifies with being a surgeon, first and foremost. But when Justin asked me to talk about a failure, so again, like Tim, there's so many failures that we all suffer from. And I think, and Tim and I talked about this and what we were going to talk about, and I think the common theme that you are going to walk away from this with is that all of us have a ton of failures. And it's really how you overcome those failures is, you know, really what defines you. Now, so for this failure, in addition to being a surgeon, I identify very strongly with being a surgeon scientist. And so I am one of those, you know, rat surgeons, test tube pipetting scientists, as you might refer to it. I have a basic and translational research lab. Now, when you're first starting off as a faculty member, and you're hired if you are on this path. And nowadays, I would say that many of us are on this path, whether you do basic and translational, or if you do health services, outcomes, education, research, you name it. So we all know that one of the first things that you're going to try to do is to fund your lab, is to secure a K grant. And for me, that meant a K08. There's also K23s. And for the PhDs in the audience, maybe a K01. And this is a challenge. There's a lot of pressure on you to do this. And I think all of you know what I mean when you establish your own lab and do this. So I was fortunate enough, I was awarded my K08 award early in my faculty career, and here I am literally in the lab, and this is as a faculty member a while ago. You can see pre-LASIK and different hairdo. So what happens is after you are funded, and you're thrilled, and you're excited, you're doing your research, you're innovating, you're discovering. But then after a few years go along, you start to realize that, okay, what about securing the R01? And so this is that K to R transition. And let me tell you, when you have that K, you feel this pressure big time. Because it's kind of that moment of truth. Are you a one-hit wonder? Or are you going to be able to actually be a successful, independent investigator? So here's one of my many failures. So I did submit my R grant. And I submitted it. It was either in the end of my third year or the beginning of the fourth year, like I would suggest most people should do to stay on track. And so when I got my summary statement, there it is. First one, notice that, no score. That means triage. So for those of you who are in this spot, let me tell you, it's devastating. Because here it was, my first R01 that I was trying to get. And when you get that level of rejection, that means my grant was worse than at least half of them. It could have been way worse. You don't know. You don't even get a score. So you don't know how bad it was. And so it makes you question everything. It makes you question your self-worth and whether or not, you know, am I really a scientist? Should I be a scientist? Should I give this up? Should I go back to operating? And you go through all sorts of doubt. But it's really important when you're doing this and trying to figure out what your future is going to be, you just have to look at this as yet another challenge. And I think the common theme is we keep talking about the challenge, and it's how you get over this challenge. So I looked at this, and I just realized that I had to basically rethink what I was doing. And as Justin talked about earlier in his presidential address, you always have a plan. So you need to develop a plan. And so I thought, okay, well, what is it that I'm passionate about? So I was passionate about vascular biology, developing better therapies for our patients, and nitric oxide. And then, of course, good advice is always to capitalize on your environment. So I had recently been getting into looking at stem and progenitor cells. And there was this interesting newly kind of identified progenitor cell that actually lives in the adventitia of all of our arteries, just sitting there waiting to differentiate into some cell type. And so I started to study this, and I knew that this was what I wanted my next grant to be on. So what I did to overcome this challenge was, again, capitalize on your environment. And we had a lot of stem cell researchers at Northwestern at the time. Doug Lasorda was there. So I brought him into the team, had lots of discussions with Doug. But interestingly, if I'm studying the role of the adventitia in the arterial injury response, guess who I reached out to? Of course, Alec Clues, who is, you know, in my eyes, you know, the godfather of vascular biology research, and it's even hard for me to talk about that right now. But okay, so through talks with Alec, because for me, you know, he always had all the landmark papers showing the importance of the media in the arterial injury response. And really, not many people were talking about the adventitia, so I was challenging his way of thinking. I said, who better to get onto my team but the person I have to prove to that actually adventitial cells are important? So I reached out to Alec, and he was amazing. I mean, I consider him my godfather mentor. And then he put me in contact with Mark Majeski at Washington. I'd never met this guy ever. And actually, I want to tell you, to this day, I have not met him. But he was so willing to help me with this research, and we kind of developed a distant collaboration. And then I also involved a longtime chemist. But you can see the pattern, because I think one of the biggest mistakes with my original R01 is I was trying to do it alone, and I think we all know that that's something you don't want to do in today's day and age. So I really capitalized on my environment and pulling in experts to help me. Now, what does this look like? So when you go through a grant, anyone who's asked my advice will know. This was a screenshot I took from my laptop. This shows the many versions that this grant went through, and the revision, and the revision, and the revision. And I had all of them give me input. My aims evolved, and I can't even, it went up to like 30-something revisions, but that's how I do it. But that's what it takes to make that good. And so, of course, the good part to this was I submitted that grant and got a perfect score. And that's probably the only perfect score I'm ever going to get in my life. But it's because I really had a plan, right, as Justin said, and sought the expertise and the help. And I really got a lot of help from all of them. And it was so, so important to do that. So again, the common theme is we all experience a ton of failure. And let me tell you, I have many more grants that have been triaged. That is not the only one. And we all experience that. So don't think that those of us who are wildly funded, I'm sure Dory, and I know Dory and Justin, who were mentioned earlier, also have grants that have been triaged. So we all suffer failure. It's just figuring out how you're going to overcome it. And as my other mentor, Bill Pierce, would say, it's the grit that you have and really figuring out how to overcome it. So with that, I will say thank you.
Thanks, Nina. Thanks, Melina. That was great. We learned a lot. Not to mention that the same mentor can result in two very different products. Sorry, Mike. So our next speaker is Mary Hahn, who's currently the chair at Stanford University.
I just want to point out all of these songs are in some way related to failures that we've had. I'm not implying that the speakers are, but that the speakers are speaking about failures.
Because you had a bad day.
Well, that is perfect because I had a really bad day that I'm going to tell you about. So I was a health services researcher, and we had a VA-funded center in Birmingham. And we were rocking and rolling. I was a junior investigator. We were growing in size, and so we had to move to a new location, lease space. And we were also growing in size in our data as well, and we're having trouble storing it. So we had our steering committee, which you have to do every year, and our steering committee came on Friday, and they were so excited with all the great things we were doing. They said, you should apply for the next level. You should be a center of excellence. And so everybody went home that week and felt great, and then we walk in Monday morning. And a couple things were missing from our center. So one was the easy button, and that was one of my staff's buttons that they had on their desk, and that was gone. But so was an external hard drive. And, in the VA, they're a little sensitive today to being lost. There have been a couple of front story pages, papers in the New York Times and things like that about federal data being lost. And this disk had veteran data on it. So what do we do? So the programmer who had the external hard drive that had gone missing called and reported it, and the police came. And then it became pretty clear that we had a data breach. So what happens in the VA when you have a data breach? Well, it's bad. Uh-oh. And then all these investigators come in. So we had the Office of Research Oversight, the Office of Information and Technology, the Office of the Inspector General. And they really wanted to know what happened. How could this possibly happen? Well, we all know why it happened. It was two reasons. But that's not really what they wanted to find out. So first, we got closed down, all our IRBs were suspended, we couldn't do research. And not only could we not do research, none of the other centers could do research across the country. They shut them all down, which made us really popular. And so so slowly, the other centers all got kind of opened back up again, but we didn't. We stayed shut down, and these investigations went on. So the first thing they did, what the VA likes to do, is they detailed our staff to the call center to take the phone calls from any, there is a number for veterans to call if they were afraid their data was gone. And so they detailed our staff to this call center. They had no training. It was after hours, nights and weekends. So I would go in and I would go to the call center and do some shifts with them and order them pizza. And my husband would harass them, pretending he was a veteran who had his data lost and call them up on the phone. But that went on for a while. And then finally they contracted it out to somebody else to take those. And very few people called. People weren't really worried about their data being gone. And then the second thing they did is they picked on the lowest and the people with the least power in our center and interviewed them constantly. They made them take sworn testimony and oath. They tape recorded them. They had no representation. They had no lawyers. And our staff didn't really know what they could do about it. They were constantly being asked questions. And what they really didn't want to know is that in our new lease facility, the front door didn't lock. So that might be a good reason maybe why the data went missing. They thought the students who worked there had stolen it and maybe were going to sell it. So they like would go to their homes where they lived and things like that. It was pretty intimidating. And what they really wanted to know about was who was sleeping with who was using drugs, who had some, you know, axe grind against somebody else, and why did this hard drive go missing, that there was really something nefarious. So if you ever read or listen to an OIG report, there's always going to be some salacious details because that's all they really care about. They didn't care about that, you know, we didn't have any place to store our data, so we went to Best Buy and bought an external hard drive, and we didn't, yes, it was in violation of the regulations, and we weren't supposed to do that, but we didn't know what else to do, and that the door didn't lock, and we didn't have physical security. That was not interesting to them. Our staff were really upset. They didn't know what to do. They just felt like they kept asking for this sworn testimony, trying to get them to say things and leading them that, you know, there was really nothing more to the story. And so the second thing I did is I hired a lawyer for them. So they, you know, at first they went through the VA and through HR there, and they said, nope, you know, there's nothing. You've got to comply with all this. So I called one of my friends and I said, do you have a lawyer who can advise them? He goes, I got just the guy. And he was a federal litigator. And he sat down and he told them exactly what they could say, what they didn't have to do. And it just was amazingly relieving for them. And the other thing is when I finally had to go in, so the faculty they brought in last, so when I went in, I brought my own tape recorder. And I put it down on the table and they said, what's that? And I said, it's a tape recorder. And they said, well, what is it for? And I said, well, you're recording this. I want to record this. That lasted about 2 minutes, and they were done. They had no more questions for me. Because I just thought it would be really interesting for other people to hear what kind of questions they really wanted to know about what had happened in our center. So 15 months later, we're finally getting ready to open up. So I had to keep my staff busy. We were not allowed to do research. So, you know, can we do systematic reviews? What can we do? Can we... you know, we've got like, you know, some things printed out that we were writing papers on and lying to the editors, you know, like when you have to sign that thing, who had controlled the data? You know, it's like, we do, somewhere. and so to get some papers published. But so 15 months later, what happened? The programmer who reported the data, the hard disk going missing, was fired. The administrative director of our center was fired. The director and co-director resigned in lieu of termination, and the director of our VA facility was fired over one hard drive going. So there's nobody left but me and one other person to open the center. And so we reopened, and we had a lot of support from central office. They felt really bad. They were pretty silent with this whole thing going on. And this is what we found. So when they took all our data away, we had to put it all on disk, and this is what it looked like. It was just like in a closet somewhere. And you know, you're sorting through there, trying to find out where was that study, where were we in it, how can we get those data back? And then they just put it all on a server, and like, you know, no file order, things like that. So it took months to find the data, these projects that had been suspended for 15 months, and get them back up going again. So I think the lesson here is really about accidental leadership. I never saw myself as a leader, but I learned more leadership lessons in those 15 months than I think I have at any other time in my career. And so I learned about my own leadership style, and I learned about others. I learned about good leadership, and I learned about bad leadership. And so whenever you find yourself in one of these adverse circumstances, and you don't know what's going to happen and how to keep your team together and things like that, just a big opportunity for learning. So thank you.
Thanks, Mary. That sounds like more than one bad day. That sounds like several bad days strung together. So our next speaker is Keith Lillimo, who's the chair at Massachusetts General Hospital and the editor of Annals of Surgery, and my boss in that role, as I'm his associate editor.
Right. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your...
Thank you very much, Justin, and my personal congratulations to you on your presidency. It's good to see your medical students going on to success. Before I start talking about failures, I want to talk about a success. First of all, I look around, and I know I'm 10 to 15 years older than most of the panelists and the officers, 20 to 30 years older than most of the people in the audience, members, residents, medical students that are here. And I remember these organizations, the AAS, the SUS, back in the day. We tended to go to the sites of host institutions. Don't offend anybody, but great places like Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Jackson, Mississippi, and hard places to get to in February. And they were struggling. Both organizations were struggling. I was fortunate enough at one time to be the president of the SUS. And my presidential address was called SUS SOS, Save Our Society. And I really thought the societies were going down. And I made a number of proposals. One was to have the meeting in great places, and congratulations to coming here in Las Vegas, to work together, a bunch of things we made, to look out at this audience and see this crowd. And I just have to congratulate all those officers through those years that went through this tough tradition, or a tough change in tradition, through this tough process, put aside their egos, their own leadership opportunities, make this happen, so I congratulate you. So start my timer again, okay? Secondly, I've been asked to speak at a number of forums recently related to this meeting, and frankly, it's usually now about membership or mentorship and career development at all, and not about science or even clinical activities, but I think I've hit a new low when they asked me to talk about failures. So what's my title mean? I've been asked that many times. Yogi Berra. So the day I got the email from Justin about this, he said, and come up with a catchy title. That was the day Yogi Berra died. And in Boston, I'm one of the few Yankee fans that are proud to show it. I have a chair from old Yankee Stadium in my office. I've got lots of pictures of memorabilia. So, and those of you, again, who aren't old enough to remember Yogi Berra, he has a great series of yogiisms, some of which are very famous. Again, you come to the fork of the road, you take it. And I thought the title that I chose sort of fit with this. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about a story that I think many of you may aspire to. You maybe will aspire to. You aspire to, because somewhere deep in your heart, you want to be a chairman. You want to be a chief, or you want to run a cancer center. You want to run something along those lines. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. I grew up in South Dakota, so a great move was leaving South Dakota. I was fortunate enough to get accepted after 2 years of medical school of South Dakota, which it was a two-year school, to transfer to Johns Hopkins. A good choice was I had an opportunity at that time to maybe go on to Baylor, but I passed on that and came to Hopkins. When I came to Hopkins as the third-year student, our chairman was George Zeidema. And again, I think it's appropriate to point that out, and as Justin did in his talk, Dr. Zeidema founded this organization. He was very, very kind to me and made a great impression, and I still value all the things I learned from George. And there'll be a side story about George a little later on as I go. I follow the theme of Michigan. I am not a Tom Brady fan. He deflates those balls so those little girl-like hands can't hold them. And if he deflated them against the Colts, I damn well know he deflated them against my Ravens the week before. So I almost left Hopkins to go to Michigan to residency. So Tim, that was almost where I went, but they offered me the chance to stay on the house staff at Hopkins. It was still the pyramid at those days, but I stayed and decided, it worked out pretty well. And it was a great opportunity for me, and I developed great friendships and great mentorship from Dr. Cameron. And it was probably, I would say, maybe the best part of my life. because I got to recruit great applicants, like several of them that are here. Got to work with great young faculty. I got to work with great senior faculty. I had just enough responsibility that I didn't get into too much trouble, but it was a great opportunity. But I looked at a number of chair jobs, and I considered many of them and came close a few times, maybe a second visit. But it sort of got beaten into me that I was going to be Dr. Cameron's successor. Now maybe that was in my mind, maybe it was other people's mind, but it certainly was in everybody's mind. And just before the search process opened up at Hopkins, I was literally offered the job at Michigan. And it was really hard because I love Ann Arbor, I had a great affinity for the University of Michigan. It had been three times I'd been there in my career to think about going. And I ultimately turned it down. And I turned it down because, not that I thought I would get the job at Hopkins, but I thought I would always want to at least have that opportunity to say I tried. And as it turned out, it was probably great for the University of Michigan. Mike will know this. Mike was not the second choice. I said when I talked to the dean, I said, I know you have another person you're considering, but I really think Mike Mulholland's going to be the best person for that job. I really think, having looked at this department, he has what it takes to lead. And I think Justin and so many of the faculty here are a perfect example of that was the right decision. I'm sorry Mike's not here, but the fact that he's home with family says lots of things about Mike. But they made the right decision. I didn't make the right decision. I didn't get the job at Hopkins. I was devastated. So I moved on to Plan B. Turns out, kind of simultaneously, Duke was looking for a chief. And I said, that made sense. Blaylock's handpicked successor was David Sabiston. Instead, they chose George Zeidema. Where did David go? He went to Duke. The rest is history. I think, arguably, David Sabiston is one of the most famous contributing surgeons in American history. I'm proud to be in his lineage at Annals of Surgery. But David went to Duke, and although he was a tremendous success in every aspect of his career, he never stopped hating Hopkins. And in 20-some years, the first medical student to come from Duke to Hopkins, and I apologize, I say this with the utmost respect to Dr. Sabiston. The first medical student to come to Hopkins was Herb Chen. And I think to get Herb to come, I almost offered to drive down and pick up him and Harriet in a truck and bring him up to Baltimore. So I didn't get the Duke job. So I was at the American College of Surgeons about 2 weeks there after. And I was glum and I was walking around. Everybody knew I was a failure. I didn't get the job I really wanted. Didn't get the Duke job. And Frank Spencer, many of you know, he's now the retired former chief at NYU. He was a Blaylock resident in the 50s. He stayed on the faculty. Frank is a great person and a great friend of mine personally and a great friend of Hopkins. And Frank pulled me aside at the San Francisco Hilton. I can point you to the right corner where he sat me down. And he said a couple things to me that really meant a lot. He said, "Keith, I know how low you are. I know how bad you feel. I know how disappointed you are. But," he said, "pick yourself up. Don't stop." Just like Tim said, just keep climbing that ladder. And the other thing he said, "don't be like David. Don't hold a grudge. Don't be hateful." And again, there are a lot of people here with Hopkins connections, Dory and people. And I have to say, for 13, 14 years, I go back for the biennial. Whenever they ask me to speak, whatever I can do, I've stayed loyal to that institution. And I think because of that, Herb Zay said something to me the other day. He came up and Herb was looking at a job and whatever. And he said, it was a great opportunity to come up and kiss the ring. And frankly, some of the best mentorship I do these days are with, you know, the former Hopkins residents and Hopkins faculty and things along those lines. And I think because I did that, I was able to maintain the kind of relationship with so many of you and hopefully the next generation that come from you. So I went to IU. It was a great opportunity. It was kind of like your first house. It was a little bit of a fixer-upper. And I thought we did a great job. I recruited a bunch of my friends, many from Hopkins. I thought we had a great department. I would say we probably, in my mind, had overall the best pancreatic surgery group ever assembled, maybe even better than Cameron, Yo, and Lilimo, and that big computer that was up on the screen earlier. But it was a great opportunity, and it was a very tough decision. You'd think everybody's it's a no-brainer to go from Indiana to the MGH, but when given the MGH opportunity, I did take it, and I did. It's been a great job. I don't think I've ever worked as hard as I have for the last 5 years, but I love it, and it's great. It's fun seeing again the absolutely outstanding quality of people that I get a chance to work with. And right now, I'm 30 minutes late for a conference call for the Brigham and Women's Search Committee. I got all your names on the list here. Frankly, nobody on the committee knows anybody, but I know everybody, so they kind of are waiting for me to get on the call. But I'm going to give you a bit of warning, okay? Anybody who ever thinks search committees are assembled to pick the best person for a job, you're wrong. Every search committee has an agenda. Every search committee has politics. Sometimes those agendas are very worthwhile and lawful. Sometimes the politics and the personalities get in the way. And if and when you do get disappointed by the results of a search committee, take the advice of Frank Spencer. Pick yourself up and keep trying. And hopefully you'll have the success that I feel I've had. And again, I think I'm better because of that mistake. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Dr. Lilimo. So our final speaker is Carla Pugh from the University of Wisconsin.
So the question was, which mathematical algorithm would help me solve my problem? Would it be a clustering algorithm, or Fourier transformation, visual analytics? And this guy had the answer. He said, well, I think you have a time series problem. And this can be avoided if you try a Markov model. So that's what we did. The engineer in my story is Jacob Rosen. At the time of this conversation, he was assistant professor of robotics and engineering at the University of Washington. And the setting where we had this conversation and we continue to have many others was a meeting called Medicine Meets Virtual Reality. It's a conference that started back in the 90s, and it has an eclectic group of engineers and computer scientists, virtual reality type of people, and a small handful of physicians. And this is some of the data that Jacob Rosen helped me to analyze with my sensors and physical examinations. And we would present a number of different takes on some of the data that I was collecting at this meeting. We published together in the journal for the conference journal, Medicine Meets Virtual Reality. It's indexed in PubMed. We also published in IEEE journals. And I was having the time of my life. This was fascinating to me because I knew there was something in the data. I had struggled for years to find someone to partner with me. I didn't even know how to talk about it. I got shut out of a number of conversations. And I finally had a partner, and I was having a great time. But I was living in two worlds. One world with finite element modeling and a bunch of algorithms, and loud people behind a curtain. And all of the math that went into what we call virtual reality, many of the simulators you all use today, the engineers were at this meeting 20 years ago working out the algorithm. And I was hanging out with them and I was amazed, waiting for the Star Trek holiday. And then I was doing surgery, which we all know. Fascinating, best job on the face of Earth. So here's a problem. It was a setup. It was definitely a setup for the perfect career mistake. My two worlds. At that time, which was really a long time ago, simulation wasn't even a household term in the medical field. But it had a long history in engineering from all the calculations and algorithms that they were doing. All of my mentors were engineers. Completely different world. Being a chair for them is an onerous, obligatory thing to do, and they take turns doing it. It's very different. They love their research. It's a very different world. And I was publishing in engineering journals. Here's the problem. My biggest goal was to make changes in surgical education. So how's that going to work? So fast forward a number of years. I get a surgical mentor to take a fine-tooth comb to my CV. And this person calls me in the office, and this unnamed person would say to me, "Why are you publishing in this journal? This journal has an impact factor of zero." Well, I have to say, I can't even remember what my response was. I don't have any memory, but I know how I felt. And these pictures can kind of describe how I felt. I felt this way for a long time. And then I began to ask myself, I mean, how can this be? I've never even heard of an impact factor of zero. And I know that I had looked it up before because I knew impact factors were important. I was like, this can't be, but this is a credible person. And so this was a little confusing for me. I mean, I knew it was at least 1.5. And I was just, you know, I was just floored for several days. So I got up the courage to go to the internet and look up the journal, and there it was. It was the impact factor zero. And I was like, so what's going on here? And then I look at this meeting, Medicine Meets Virtual Reality, had a sister meeting, happened at the exact same time, and had its second journal called Cybertherapy and Rehabilitation. And that was, I mean, that was the biggest thing since sliced bread back then. And at this point in time, it also now had impact factor zero. And I'm like, what's going on here? And so then I look at the first journal that actually had simulation in the title that came out a while ago, and when it first hit the stage, it had an impact factor of 2, and I was sure, you know, maybe this journal has sort of taken over, and now the impact factor's going up. It's going down. Every year, it's going down. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here? This is very interesting. So Simulation in Healthcare, which is the named journal, now is going to have the fate of the Medicine Meets Virtual Reality journal. And then when I looked at it, there are so many other journals that the editors of these, the original journals, are putting out. And they're splitting off as the science develops. And so now these are the journals that have an impact factor that's somewhat decent. So now I'm starting to get it. There's this, you know, initial journals that come out in the technology area, but once there's more information about it, then there are other separate journals, and then that old one just kind of dies. As I continue to console myself, because this is still on my CV, this journal, I realized the big gift for me was all of the engineers that I learned how to speak to, that partnered with me, and pretty much made me who I am today, just in terms of my collaborations with them. And it's ongoing, and it's very exciting. Chang Liu was my senior mentor on my R01 grant, which then got me a PCASE award, a trip to the White House, and a number of huge honors that have just been quite fascinating and have brought me more collaborations on the engineering side, which is extremely helpful because I'm still trying to crack the code. I still got a little bit of a time series problem. I still got problems with all of the algorithms, and the engineers are loving it now. And I'm loving it because they're coming out of the woodworks to help me with this data. Same thing with the TED Med conference. Engineers coming out of the woodwork and other computer scientists, and it's just been a whole lot of fun. And I've now had an experience with an impact factor on the other side of the spectrum. But I have to tell you, at the end of the day, it's this group of people that gets me up in the morning. I feel incredibly honored to be able to have students knocking at my door to come and work in my lab. I have students from the robotic and engineering departments, signal processing, biomedical engineering, undergrads, one of them presenting here today. It's a huge honor. It really is. And again, when I look back at it, who would I have to thank? Those engineers that took the time to listen. And medicine meets virtual reality. What's really fun is that the science is now evolving. And the engineers keep telling me, you know, you really have a big data problem. And I was like, you know, I remember many years ago someone told me I didn't, because it's not like DNA unfolding. It's not that kind of data. And they said, no, well, big data has to do with data complexity. And this is where you fit in. You've got a variety of data. You've got motion tracking data. You've got sensor data. You've got video data. You've got discourse. You've got all of this data. And then you have human decisions that you're looking at. So that's where your time series come in. All of those waveforms that I get, that's not a heart rate that's regular and you know when it's gonna come. It's a human being making a decision. How long they stay in one place and then they decide to move. And they do something different and they do something fast and they do something slow. And that's what makes the data complex. And so now there's a science with a name to it, and I'm embarking on a new endeavor. So I'm excited to look at this, and I've got some new colleagues that have invited me to, guess what, another obscure meeting. So this June, I'm going to go to Germany and hang out with a small group of, once again, eclectic engineers, and I'm 100% sure that I'm going to be publishing in the unabridged Berlin Journal of Surgical Data Science. And I'm looking forward to it because I think that's going to set the next frontier for me, and I'm having the time of my life. I really am. And so if I have any advice to give you today, it would be, if you're going to publish in a low-impact journal, make sure that it's with high-impact people that make a high impact on your ideas. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carla. That concludes our formal speakers, but we have one more speaker. Dr. Segev is going to quickly summarize the session for us all and close it out. So I'll turn it over to Dory.
Yeah, Justin was afraid that you might forget the earlier messages because things were so exciting that I've written down some of the take-home points from the speakers, and some might be a little tongue-in-cheek. So Tim Pollack taught us that don't wear an ugly striped shirt and Teva sandals when you meet your wife. Instead, get your dating advice from Seinfeld. If your paper in medical school never got published, just make sure you write like 200 a year as faculty. You can go to Michigan even if it's your fifth choice, because one day you'll reach the Holy Land of Hopkins. And if you have over 50% mortality, switch to baseball. You'll be called a legend. Mike Anglesby taught us, go to Michigan, be like Tom Brady, try to look like Tom Brady, but be careful what you're good at, especially if you're doing basic science, because when the shit hits the fan, you want to cross-dress. Melina Kibbe taught us that first you should watch a lot of sci-fi, because then you can think creatively. But don't let an NIH study section change your life plan. Just find some other obscure stem cell to study and build up your team with people you've never met. From Mary Hahn's bad day that lasted 15 months, we learned if you're going to lose a hard drive, don't do it at the VA. If you do, hire a lawyer, bring a tape recorder, and replace the front lock so maybe it doesn't happen again. Keith Lillimo first taught us that if you want to save a society, have meetings in exciting destinations like Jacksonville. And then I'll summarize maybe his other two things using little poems. So this is Tom. Tom deflates footballs. Tom went to Michigan, but don't be like Tom. This is David. David got booted from Hopkins. David hated Hopkins. Don't be like David. And Carla Pugh finally reminded us that if you're living between two disparate worlds and publishing in journals which have no impact, use a Markov model, hang out with cool engineers, and maybe send your B-rate stuff to the New England Journal.
All right. That is officially it. Thank you all for coming, and I hope you had fun.
Well, we all hoped you enjoyed the Failing Forward panel discussion. It was truly amazing and some great speakers on there. Upcoming for us at Behind the Knife is that we are following the Trauma, Critical Care, and Acute Care Surgery Conference March 21st to March 23rd in Vegas. So we'll be giving you live updates from there, similar to what we did at ASC. If you're a new follower, please check us out at Behind the Knife on Twitter and at www.behindtheknife.org. As our website, where you can actually see all the podcasts as well as leave comments on your favorite podcasts or create a discussion. So until next time, dominate the day.